what Ygritte would have done in her place. The women are the strong ones. He found himself thinking about Sam and Maester Aemon, about Gilly and the babe. She will curse me with her dying breath, but I saw no other way. Eastwatch reported savage storms upon the narrow sea. I meant to keep them safe. Did I feed them to the crabs instead? Last night he had dreamed of Sam drowning, of Ygritte dying with his own arrow in her. It had not been his arrow, but in his dreams it always was. Of Gilly weeping tears of blood. Jon Snow had seen enough. Now, he said. Alma of the Kingswood jammed his spear into the ground, unslung his bow, and slipped a black arrow from his quiver. Sweet Donald Hill threw back his hood to do the same. Garth Greyfeather and Bearded Ben knocked shafts, bent their bows, loosed. One arrow took Mance Rayder in the chest, one in the gut, one in the throat. The four struck one of the cage's wooden bars and quivered for an instant before catching fire. A woman's sobs echoed off the wall as the wildling king slid bonelessly to the floor of his cage, wreathed in fire. And now his watch is done, John murmured softly. Mance Rayder had been a man of the night's watch once, before he changed his black cloak for one slashed with bright red silk. Up on the platform, Stannis was scowling. John refused to meet his eyes. The bottom had fallen out of the wooden cage, and its bars were crumbling. Every time the fire licked upward, more branches tumbled free, cherry red and black.
The Lord of Light made the sun and moon and stars to light our way and gave us fire to keep the night at bay, Melisandre told the wildlings. None can withstand his flames.
None can withstand his flames, the queen's men echoed. The red woman's robes of deep-dyed scarlet swirled about her, and her coppery hair made a halo round her face. Tall yellow flames danced from her fingertips like claws.
Free folk, your false gods cannot help you. Your false horn did not save you. Your false king brought you only death, despair, defeat. But here stands the true king. Behold his glory.
Stannis Baratheon drew Lightbringer. The sword glowed, red and yellow and orange, alive with light. John had seen the show before, but not like this. Never before like this. Lightbringer was the sun made steel. When Stannis raised the blade above his head, men had to turn their heads or cover their eyes. Horses shied, and one threw his rider. The blaze in the fire pit seemed to shrink before this storm of light, like a small dog cowering before a larger one. The wall itself turned red and pink and orange as waves of colour danced across the ice. Is this the power of king's blood?
Westeros has but one king, said Stannis. His voice rang harsh with none of Melisandre's music. With this sword I defend my subjects and destroy those who menace them. Bend the knee, and I promise you food, land, and justice. Kneel and live, or go and die. The choice is yours.
He slipped Lightbringer into its scabbard, and the world darkened once again, as if the sun had gone behind a cloud.
Open the gates! Open the gates! Bellowed Sir Clayton Suggs, in a voice as deep as a war horn. Open the gates! Echoed Sir Corlys Penny, commanding the guards. Open the gates! Cried the sergeants. Men scrambled to obey. Sharpened stakes were wrenched from the ground, planks were dropped across deep ditches, and the stockade gates were thrown wide. Jon Snow raised his hand and lowered it, and his black ranks parted right and left, clearing a path to the wall, where Dolorous Ed Tullet pushed open the iron gate.
Come, urged Melisandre. Come to the light, or run back to the darkness.
In the pit below her, the fire was crackling.
If you choose life, come to me.
And they came, slowly at first, Some limping or leaning on their fellows, the captives began to emerge from their rough-hewn pen. "If you would eat, come to me," John thought. "If you would not freeze or starve, submit." Hesitant, weary of some trap, the first few prisoners edged across the planks and through the ring of stakes, toward Melisandre and the wall. More followed when they saw that no harm had come to those who went before, then more, until it was a steady stream. Queen's men in studded jacks and half-helms handed each passing man, woman, or child a piece of white weirwood, a stick, a splintered branch as pale as broken bone, a spray of blood-red leaves. A piece of the old guards to feed the new. John flexed the fingers of his sword hand. The heat from the fire pit was palpable even at a distance. For the wildlings, it had to be blistering. He saw men cringing as they neared the flames, heard children cry. A few turned for the forest. He watched a young woman stumble away with a child on either hand. Every few steps, she looked back to make certain no one was coming after them, and when she neared the trees, she broke into a run. One greybeard took the weirwood branch they handed him and used it as a weapon, laying about with it until the queen's men converged on him with spears. The others had to step around his body until Sir Corlys had it thrown in the fire. More of the free folk chose the woods after that, 1 in 10 perhaps, but most came on. Behind them was only cold and death. Ahead was hope. They came on, clutching their scraps of wood, until the time came to feed them to the flames. R'hllor was a jealous deity, ever hungry. So the new god devoured the corpse of the old, and cast gigantic shadows of Stannis and Melisandre upon the wall, black against the ruddy red reflections on the ice. Sigorn was the first to kneel before the king. The new Magnathen was a younger, shorter version of his father, lean, balding, clad in bronze greaves and a leather shirt sewn with bronze scales. Next came Rattleshirt, in clattering armor made of bones and boiled leather, his helm a giant's skull. Under the bones lurked a ruined and wretched creature with cracked brown teeth and a yellow tinge to the whites of his eyes. A small, malicious, treacherous man, as stupid as he is cruel. John did not believe for a moment that he would keep faith. He wondered what Val was feeling as she watched him kneel, forgiven. Lesser leaders followed. 2 clan chiefs of the Horned Footmen, whose feet were black and hard, an old wise woman revered by the peoples of the Milkwater, a scrawny dark-eyed boy of 2 and 10, the son of Alfin Crowkiller, Halleck, brother to Harmer Dog's Head, with her pigs. Each took a knee before the king. "It is too cold for this mummer's show," thought John. "The free folk despise kneelers," he had warned Stannis. "Let them keep their pride, and they will love you better." His grace will not listen. He said, "It is swords I need from them, not kisses." Having knelt, the wildling shuffled past the ranks of the Black Brothers to the gate. John had detailed horse and satin and 6 others to lead them through the wall with torches. On the far side, bowls of hot onion soup awaited them, and chunks of black bread and sausage. Clothes as well, cloaks, breeches, boots, tunics, good leather gloves. They would sleep on piles of clean straw, with fires blazing to keep the chill of night at bay. This king was nothing if not methodical. Soon or late, however, Tormund Giantsbane would assault the wall again, and when that hour came, John wondered whose side Stannis' new-made subjects would choose. You can give them land and mercy, but the free folk choose their own kings, and it was Mance they chose, not you. Bowen Marsh edged his mount up next to John's. "This is a day I never thought to see." The Lord Steward had thinned notably since suffering a head wound at the Bridge of Skulls. Part of one ear was gone. He no longer looks much like a pomegranate, John thought. Marsh said, "We bled to stop the wildlings at the gorge. Good men were slain there, friends and brothers. For what?"
"The realm will curse us all for this," declared Sir Alistair Thorne in a venomous tone. "Every honest man in Westeros will turn his head and spit at the mention of the Night's Watch."
"What would you know of honest men?"
"Quiet in the ranks!"
Sir Alistair had grown more circumspect since Lord Janus had lost his head, but the malice was still there. John had toyed with the idea of giving him the commands Slint had refused, but he wanted the man close. He was always the more dangerous of the two. Instead, he had dispatched a grizzled steward from the Shadow Tower to take command at Greyguard. He hoped the two new garrisons would make a difference. "The watch can make the free folk bleed, but in the end we cannot hope to stop them." Giving Mansraider to the fire did not change the truth of that. We are still too few, and they are still too many, and without rangers we're good as blind. I have to send men out, but if I do, will they come back again? The tunnel through the wall was narrow and twisting, and many of the wildlings were old or ill or wounded, so the going was painfully slow. By the time the last of them had bent the knee, night had fallen. The pit fire was burning low, and the king's shadow on the wall had shrunk to a quarter of its former height. Jon Snow could see his breath in the air. "Cold," he thought, "and getting colder. This mummer show has gone on long enough." 20 captives lingered by the stockade. 4 giants were among them, massive, hairy creatures with sloped shoulders, legs as large as tree trunks, and huge splayed feet. Big as they were, they might still have passed through the wall, but one would not leave his mammoth, and the others would not leave him. The rest of those who remained were all of human stature. Some were dead, and some were dying. More were their kin, or close companions, unwilling to abandon them even for a bowl of onion soup. Some shivering, some too numb to shiver, they listened as the king's voice rumbled off the wall. "You are free to go," Stannis told them. "Tell your people what you witnessed. Tell them that you saw the true king and that they are welcome in his realm, so long as they keep his peace. Elsewise, they had best flee or hide. I will brook no further attacks upon my wall."
"One realm, one god, one king," cried Lady Melisandre.
The queen's men took up the cry, beating the butts of their spears against their shields.
"One realm, one god, one king. Stannis, Stannis, one realm, one god, one king."
Val did not join the chant, he saw, nor did the brothers of the Night's Watch. During the tumult, the few remaining wildlings melted into the trees. The giants were the last to go, 2 riding on the back of a mammoth, the other 2 afoot. Only the dead were left behind. John watched Stannis descend from the platform with Melisandre by his side, his red shadow. She never leaves his side for long. The king's honor guard fell in around him. Sir Godfrey, Sir Clayton, and 12 other knights, queen's men all. Moonlight shimmered on their armor, and the wind whipped at their cloaks. "Lord Stuart," John told Marsh, "break up that stockade for firewood and throw the corpses in the flames."
"As my lord commands."
Marsh barked out orders, and a swarm of his stewards broke from ranks to attack the wooden walls. The Lord Steward watched them, frowning. "These wildlings, do you think they will keep faith, my lord?" "Some will, not all. We have our cowards and our knaves, our weaklings and our fools, as do they. Our vows, we are sworn to protect the realm. Once the free folk are settled in the gift, they will become part of the realm," John pointed out. "These are desperate days, and like to grow more desperate. We have seen the face of our real foe, a dead white face with bright blue eyes. The free folk have seen that face as well. Stannis is not wrong in this. We must make common cause with the wildlings. Common cause against a common foe, I could agree with that, said Bowen Marsh, but that does not mean we should allow tens of thousands of half-starved savages through the wall. Let them return to their villages and fight the others there, whilst we seal the gates. It will not be difficult, as Athel tells me. We need only fill the tunnels with chunks of stone and pour water through the murder holes. The wall does the rest. The cold, the weight, in a moon's turn, it will be as if no gate had ever been. Any foe would need to hack his way through. Or climb. Oh, unlikely, said Bowen Marsh. These are not raiders, out to steal a wife and some plunder. Tormund will have old women with him, children, herds of sheep and goats, even mammoths. He needs a gate, and only three of those remain. And if he should send climbers up, well, defending against climbers is as simple as spearing fish in a kettle. Fish never climb out of the kettle and shove a spear through your belly. John had climbed the wall himself. Marsh went on. Man's raiders, Bowman, must have loosed 10,000 arrows at us, judging from the number of spent shafts we've gathered up. Fewer than 100 reached our men atop the wall, most of those lifted by some errant gust of wind. Red Allen of the Rosewood was the only man to die up there, and it was his fall that killed him, not the arrow that pricked his leg. Donald Noy died to hold the gate. A gallant act, yes. But if the gate had been sealed, our brave armourer might still be with us. Whether we face 100 foes or 100,000, so long as we're atop the wall and they're below, they cannot do us harm. He is not wrong. Mansraider's host had broken against the wall like a wave upon a stony shore, though the defenders were no more than a handful of old men, green boys, and cripples. Yet what Bowen was suggesting went against all of John's instincts. If we seal the gates, we cannot send out rangers, he pointed out. We will be as good as blind. Lord Mormont's last ranging cost the watch a quarter of its men, my lord. We need to conserve what strength remains us. Every death diminishes us, and we are stretched so thin. Take the high ground and win the battle, my uncle used to say. No ground is higher than the wall, Lord Commander. Stannis promises land, food, and justice to any wildlings who bend the knee. He will never permit us to seal the gates. Marsh hesitated. Lord Snow, I'm not one to bear tales, but there has been talk that you are becoming too friendly with Lord Stannis. Some even suggest that you are a rebel and a turncloak, aye, and a bastard and a warg as well. Janus Slint might be gone, but his lies lingered. I know what they say. John had heard the whispers, had seen men turn away when you crossed the yard. What would they have me do? Take up swords against Stannis and the wildlings both? His grace has thrice the fighting men we do, and is our guest besides. The laws of hospitality protect him, and we owe him and his a debt. Lord Stannis helped us when we needed help, Marsh said doggedly. But he is still a rebel, and his cause is doomed as we'll be if the Iron Throne marks us down as traitors. We must be certain that we do not choose the losing side. It is not my intent to choose any side, said John. But I am not as certain of the outcome of this war as you seem to be, my lord, not with Lord Tywin dead. If the tales coming up the King's Road could be believed, the King's Hand had been murdered by his dwarf son while sitting on a privy. John had known Tyrion Lannister briefly. He took my hand and named me friend. It was hard to believe the little man had it in him to murder his own sire, but the fact of Lord Tywin's demise seems to be beyond doubt. The lion in King's Landing is a cub, and the Iron Throne has been known to cut grown men to ribbons. A boy he may be, my lord, but King Robert was well loved, and most men still accept that Tommen is his son. The more they say of Lord Stannis, the less they love him. and fewer still are fond of Lady Missandra, with her fires and this grim red god of hers. They complain. They complained about Lord Commander Mormont, too. Men love to complain about their wives and lords, he told me once. Those without wives complain twice as much about their lords. Jon Snow glanced toward the stockade. Two walls were down, a third falling fast. I will leave you to finish here, Bowen. Make certain every corpse is burnt. Thank you for your counsel. I promise you I will think on all you've said. Smoke and drifting ash still lingered in the air about the pit as John trotted back to the gate. There he dismounted to walk his garron through the ice to the south side. Dolorous Ed went before him with a torch. Its flames licked the ceiling. So cold tears trickled down upon them with every step.
"It was a relief to see that orn burn, my lord," Ed said. "Just last night I dreamed I was pissing off the wall when someone decided to give the orn a toot. Not that I'm complaining. It was better than my old dream, where Harmer Dog's Head was feeding me to her pigs."
"Harmer's dead," John said.
"But not the pigs. They look at me the way Slayer used to look at him. Not to say that the wildlings mean us harm. I we act their gods apart and made them burn the pieces, but we gave them onion soup. What's a god compared to a nice bowl of onion soup, eh? Oh, I could do with one myself."
The odours of smoke and burned flesh still clung to John's blacks. He knew he had to eat, but it was company he craved, not food. A cup of wine with Maester Aemon, some quiet words with Sam, a few laughs with Pip and Gren and Toad. Aemon and Sam were gone, though, and his other friends. "I will take supper with the men this evening."
"Boiled beef and beets," Dolorous Ed always seemed to know what was cooking. "Ob says he's out of horseradish, though. What good is boiled beef without horseradish?"
Since the wildlings had burned the old common hall, the men of the Night's Watch took their meals in the stone cellar below the armory, a cavernous space divided by two rows of square stone pillars, with barrel-vaulted ceilings and great casks of wine and ale along the walls. When John entered, four builders were playing at tiles at the table nearest the steps. Closer to the fire sat a group of rangers and a few kingsmen, talking quietly. The younger men were gathered at another table, where Pip had stabbed a turnip with his knife.
"The night is dark and full of turnips," he announced in a solemn voice. "Let us all pray for venison, my children, with some onions and a bit of tasty gravy."
His friends laughed. Gren, Toad, Satin, the whole lot of them. Jon Snow did not join the laughter. Making mock of another man's prayer is fool's work, Pip, and dangerous.
"If the Red God's offended, let him strike me down."
All the smiles had died.
"It was the priestess we were laughing at," said Saturn, a lithe and pretty youth who had once been a whore in Old Town. "We were only having a jape, my lord."
"You have your gods and she has hers. Leave her be."
"She won't let her gods be," argued Toad. "She calls the seven false gods, my lord. The old gods, too. She made the wildlings burn weirwood branches, you saw."
"Lady Melisandre is not part of my command. You are. I won't have bad blood between the king's men and my own." Pip laid a hand on Toad's arm.
"Croak no more, brave Toad, for our great Lord Snow has spoken."
Pip hopped to his feet and gave John a mocking bow.
"I beg pardon. Henceforth I shall not even waggle my ears save by your lordship's lordly leave."
"He thinks this is all some game." John wanted to shake some sense into him. "Waggle your ears all you like. It's your tongue waggling that makes the trouble." "I'll see that he's more careful," Gren promised, "and I'll clout him if he's not." He hesitated.
"My lord, will you sup with us? Owen, shove over and make room for John."
John wanted nothing more. No, he had to tell himself, those days are gone. The realization twisted in his belly like a knife. They had chosen him to rule. The wall was his, and their lives were his as well.
"A lord may love the men that he commands," he could hear his lord father saying, "but he cannot be a friend to them. One day he may need to sit in judgment on them, or send them forth to die."
"Another day," the lord commander lied. "Ed, best see to your own supper. I have work to finish." The outside air seemed even colder than before. Across the castle, he could see candlelight shining from the windows of the king's tower. Val stood on the tower roof, gazing up at the wall. Stannis kept her closely penned in rooms above his own, but he did allow her to walk the battlements for exercise. She looks lonely, John thought, lonely and lovely. Ygritte had been pretty in her own way, with her red hair kissed by fire, but it was her smile that made her face come alive. Val did not need to smile. She would have turned men's heads in any court in the wide world. All the same, the wildling princess was not beloved of her jailers. She scorned them all as kneelers, and had thrice attempted to escape. When one man-at-arms grew careless in her presence, she had snatched his dagger from its sheath and stabbed him in the neck. Another inch to the left, and he might have died. Lonely and lovely and lethal, Jon Snow reflected. And I might have had her, her and Winterfell and my lord father's name. Instead, he had chosen a black cloak and a wall of ice. Instead, he had chosen honor, a bastard sort of honor. The wall loomed on his right as he crossed the yard. Its high ice glimmered palely, but down below all was shadow. At the gate, a dim orange glow shone through the bars where the guards had taken refuge from the wind. John could hear the creak of chains as the winch cage swung and scraped against the ice. Up top, the sentries would be huddling in the warming shed around a brazier, shouting to be heard above the wind. Or else they would have given up the effort, and each man would be sunk in his own pool of silence. "I should be walking the ice. The wall is mine." He was walking beneath the shell of the Lord Commander's tower, past the spot where Ygritte had died in his arms, when Ghost appeared beside him, his warm breath steaming in the cold. In the moonlight, his red eyes glowed like pools of fire. The taste of hot blood filled John's mouth, and he knew that Ghost had killed that night. "No," he thought, "I'm a man, not a wolf." He rubbed his mouth with the back of a gloved hand and spat. Clyda still occupied the rooms beneath the rookery. At John's knock, he came shuffling, a taper in his hand, to open the door a crack. "Do I intrude?" asked John.
"Not at all." Clydus opened the door wider. "I was mulling wine. Will your lord take a cup?"
"With pleasure." His hands were stiff from cold. He pulled off his gloves and flexed his fingers. Clydus returned to the hearth to stir the wine. "He's 60 if he's a day. An old man. He only seemed young compared with Aemon." Short and round, he had the dim pink eyes of some nocturnal creature. A few white hairs clung to his scalp. When Clydus poured, John held the cup with both hands, sniffed the spices, swallowed. The warmth spread through his chest. He drank again, long and deep, to wash the taste of blood from his mouth.
"The queen's men are saying that the king beyond the wall died craven, that he cried for mercy and denied he was a king."
"He did. Lightbringer was brighter than I'd ever seen it, as bright as the sun." John raised his cup. "To Stannis Baratheon and his magic sword." The wine was bitter in his mouth.
"His grace is not an easy man. Few are who wear the crown. Many good men have been bad kings, Maester Aemon used to say, and some bad men have been good kings."
He would know. Aemon Targaryen had seen 9 kings upon the Iron Throne. He had been a king's son, a king's brother, a king's uncle. "I looked at that book Maester Aemon left me, the J Compendium, the pages that told of Azor Ahai. Lightbringer was his sword, tempered with his wife's blood, if Votar can be believed. Thereafter, Lightbringer was never cold to the touch, but warm as Nyssa Nyssa had been warm. In battle, the blade burned fiery hot. Once Azor Ahai fought a monster. When he thrust his sword through the belly of the beast, its blood began to boil. Smoke and steam poured from its mouth. Its eyes melted and dribbled down its cheeks, and its body burst into flame. Clydus blinked.
A sword that makes its own heat.
Would be a fine thing on the wall. John put aside his wine cup and drew on his black moleskin gloves. A pity that the sword that Stannis wields is cold. I'd be curious to see how his Lightbringer behaves in battle. Thank you for the wine. Ghost, with me. Jon Snow raised the hood of his cloak and pulled at the door. The White Wolf followed him back into the night. The armory was dark and silent. Jon nodded to the guards before making his way past the silent racks of spears to his rooms. He hung his sword belt from a peg beside the door and his cloak from another. When he peeled off his gloves, his hands were stiff and cold. It took him a long while to get the candles lit. Ghost curled up on his rug and went to sleep, but John could not rest yet. The scarred pinewood table was covered with maps of the wall and the lands beyond. A roster of rangers and a letter from the Shadow Tower written in Sir Dennis Malister's flowing hand. He read the letter from the Shadow Tower again, sharpened a quill, and unstoppered a pot of thick black ink. He wrote two letters, the first to Sir Dennis, the second to Cotter Pike. Both of them had been hounding him for more men. Holder and Toad he dispatched west to the Shadow Tower, Gren and Pip to Eastwatch by the sea. The ink would not flow properly, and all his words seemed curt and crude and clumsy, yet he persisted. When he finally put the quill down, the room was dim and chilly, and he could feel its walls closing in. Perched above the window, the old bear's raven peered down at him with shrewd black eyes. "My last friend," John thought ruefully, "and I had best outlive you, or you'll eat my face as well." Ghost did not count. Ghost was closer than a friend. Ghost was part of him. John rose and climbed the steps to the narrow bed that had once been Donal Noy's. "This is my lot," he realized as he undressed. "From now until the end of my days."
Sansa. Once, when she was just a little girl, a wandering singer had stayed with them at Winterfell for half a year. An old man he was, with white hair and wind-burnt cheeks, but he sang of knights and quests and ladies fair. And Sansa had cried bitter tears when he left them, and begged her father not to let him go. "The man has played us every song he knows thrice over," Lord Eddard told her gently. "I cannot keep him here against his will. You need not weep, though, I promise you. Other singers will come." They hadn't, though, not for a year or more. Sansa had prayed to the Seven in their sept and the old gods of the Heart Tree, asking them to bring the old man back, or better still, to send another singer, a young and handsome one. But the gods never answered, and the halls of Winterfell stayed silent. But that was when she was a little girl and foolish. She was a maiden now, 3 and 10, and flowered. All her nights were full of song, and by day she prayed for silence. If the Eyrie had been made like other castles, only rats and jailers would have heard the dead man singing. Dungeon walls were thick enough to swallow songs and screams alike, but the sky cells had a wall of empty air, so every chord the dead man played flew free to echo off the stony shoulders of the giant's lance. And the songs he chose. He sang of the Dance of the Dragons, of fair Jonquil and her fool, of Jenny of Oldstones and the Prince of Dragonflies. He sang of betrayals and murders most foul, of hanged men and bloody vengeance. He sang of grief and sadness. No matter where she went in the castle, Sansa could not escape the music. It floated up the winding tower steps, found her naked in her bath, supped with her at dusk, and stole into her bedchamber even when she latched the shutters tight. It came in on the cold, thin air, and like the air, it chilled her. Though it had not snowed upon the Eyrie since the day that Lady Lysa fell, the nights had all been bitter cold. The singer's voice was strong and sweet. Sansa thought he sounded better than he ever had before, his voice richer, somehow full of pain and fear and longing. She did not understand why the gods would have given such a voice to such a wicked man. "He would have taken me by force on the fingers if Peter had not set Sir Lothar to watch over me," she had to remind herself. "And he played to drown out my cries when Aunt Lysa tried to kill me." That did not make the songs any easier to hear. "Please," she begged Lord Peter, "can't you make him stop?" "I gave the man my word, sweetling. Peter Baelish, Lord of Harrenhal, Lord Paramount of the Trident, and Lord Protector of the Eyrie and the Vale of Arryn, looked up from the letters he was writing. He had written 100 letters since Lady Lysa's fall. Sansa had seen the ravens coming and going from the rookery. I'd sooner suffer his singing than listen to his sobbing. "It is better that he sings, yes, but must he play all night, my lord? Lord Robert cannot sleep, he cries. For his mother, that cannot be helped. The wench is dead." Peter shrugged. "It will not be much longer. Lord Nestor is making his ascent on the morrow." Sansa had met Lord Nestor Royce once before, after Peter's wedding to her aunt. Royce was the keeper of the Gates of the Moon, the great castle that stood at the base of the mountain and guarded the steps up to the Eyrie. The wedding party had guested with him overnight before beginning their ascent. Lord Nestor had scarce looked at her twice, but the prospect of him coming here terrified her. He was High Steward of the Vale as well, John Arryn's trusted liegeman, and Lady Lysa's. "You won't let Lord Nestor see Marillion, will you?" Her horror must have shown on her face since Peter put down his quill. "On the contrary, I shall insist on it." He beckoned her to take the seat beside him. "We have come to an agreement, Marillion and I. Maud can be most persuasive, and if our singer disappoints us and sings a song we do not care to hear, why, you and I need only say he lies. Whom do you imagine Lord Nestor will believe?" "Us?" Sansa wished she could be certain. "Of course, our lies will profit him." The solar was warm, the fire crackling merrily, but Sansa shivered all the same. "Yes, but what if..." "What if Lord Nestor values honor more than profit?" Peter put his arm around her. "What if it is truth he wants and justice for his murdered lady?" He smiled. "I know, Lord Nestor, sweetling. Do you imagine I'd ever let him harm my daughter?" "I am not your daughter," she thought. "I am Sansa Stark, Lord Eddard's daughter, and Lady Catelyn's, the blood of Winterfell." She did not say it, though. If not for Peter Baelish, it would have been Sansa who went spinning through a cold blue sky to stony death 600 feet below, instead of Lysa Arryn. "He is so bold." Sansa wished she had his courage. She wanted to crawl back into bed and hide beneath her blanket to sleep and sleep. She had not slept a whole night through since Lysa Arryn's death. "Couldn't you tell Lord Nestor that I am indisposed, or..." "He will want to hear your account of Lysa's death." "My lord, if Marillion tells what truly..."
"If he lies, you mean?"
"Lies? Yes, if he lies. If it is my tale against his, and Lord Nestor looks in my eyes and sees how scared I am."
"A touch of fear will not be out of place, Alain. You've seen a fearful thing. Nestor will be moved."
Peter studied her eyes as if seeing them for the first time. You have your mother's eyes. Honest eyes and innocent. Blue as a sunlit sea. When you are a little older, many a man will drown in those eyes. Sansa did not know what to say to that. All you need do is tell Lord Nestor the same tale that you told Lord Robert. Peter went on. Robert is only a sick little boy, she thought. Lord Nestor is a man, grown, stern, and suspicious. Robert was not strong and had to be protected, even from the truth. Some lies are love, Peter had assured her. She reminded him of that. When we lied to Lord Robert, that was just to spare him, she said. And this lie may spare us, else you and I must leave the Eyrie by the same door Lysa used. Peter picked up his quill again. We shall serve him lies and arbor gold, and he'll drink them down and ask for more, I promise you. He is serving me lies as well, Sansa realized. They were comforting lies, though, and she thought them kindly meant. A lie is not so bad if it is kindly meant. If only she believed them. The things her aunt had said just before she fell still troubled Sansa greatly. Ravings, Peter called them. My wife was mad. You saw that for yourself. And so she had. All I did was build a snow castle, and she meant to push me out the moon door. Peter saved me. He loved my mother well, and her? How could she doubt it? He had saved her. He saved Elaine, his daughter, a voice within her whispered. But she was Sansa, too, and sometimes it seemed to her that the Lord Protector was two people as well. He was Peter, her protector, warm and funny and gentle. But he was also Littlefinger, the Lord she'd known at King's Landing, smiling slyly and stroking his beard as he whispered in Queen Cersei's ear. And Littlefinger was no friend of hers. When Joff had her beaten, the imp defended her, not Littlefinger. When the mob sought to rape her, the Hound carried her to safety, not Littlefinger. When the Lannisters wed her to Tyrion against her will, Sir Garlan the Gallant gave her comfort, not Littlefinger. Littlefinger never lifted so much as his little finger for her, except to get me out. He did that for me. I thought it was Sir Dontos, my poor old drunken Florian, but it was Peter all the while. Littlefinger was only a mask he had to wear. Only sometimes Sansa found it hard to tell where the man ended and the mask began. Littlefinger and Lord Peter looked so very much alike. She would have fled them both, perhaps, but there was nowhere for her to go. Winterfell was burned and desolate, Bran and Rickon dead and cold. Robb had been betrayed and murdered at the Twins along with their lady mother. Tyrion had been put to death for killing Joffrey, and if she ever returned to King's Landing, the Queen would have her head as well. The aunt she'd hoped would keep her safe had tried to murder her instead. Her uncle Edmure was a captive of the Freys, while her great-uncle the Blackfish was under siege at Riverrun. I have no place but here, Sansa thought miserably, and no true friend but Peter. That night the dead man sang The Day They Hanged Black Robin, The Mother's Tears, and The Rains of Castamere. Then he stopped for a while, but just as Sansa began to drift off, he started to play again. He sang Six Sorrows, Fallen Leaves, and Alysanne. Such sad songs, she thought. When she closed her eyes, she could see him in his sky cell, huddled in a corner away from the cold black sky, crouched beneath a fir with his woodharp cradled against his chest. I must not pity him, she told herself. He was vain and cruel, and soon he will be dead. She could not save him. And why should she want to? Marillion tried to rape her, and Peter had saved her life not once but twice. Some lies you have to tell. Lies had been all that kept her alive in King's Landing. If she had not lied to Joffrey, his Kingsguard would have beat her bloody. After Alysanne, The singer stopped again, long enough for Sansa to snatch an hour's rest. But as the first light of dawn was prying at her shutters, she heard the soft strains of On a Misty Morn drifting up from below and woke at once. That was more properly a woman's song, a lament sung by a mother on the dawn after some terrible battle, as she searches amongst the dead for the body of her only son. The mother sings her grief for her dead son, Sansa thought, but Marillion grieves for his fingers, for his eyes. The words rose like arrows and pierced her in the darkness. Oh, have you seen my boy, good sir? His hair is chestnut brown. He promised he'd come back to me, our homes in Wendish Town. Sansa covered her ears with a goose down pillow to shut out the rest of it, but it was no good. Day had come and she had woken, and Lord Nestor Royce was coming up the mountain. The High Steward and his party reached the Eyrie in the late afternoon, with the valley gold and red beneath them and the wind rising. He brought his son, Sir Albar, along with a dozen knights and a score of men-at-arms. So many strangers. Sansa looked at their faces anxiously, wondering if they were friends or foes. Peter welcomed his visitors in a black velvet doublet with grey sleeves that matched his woolen breeches and lent a certain darkness to his grey-green eyes. Maester Coleman stood beside him, his chain of many metals hanging loose about his long, skinny neck. Although the maester was much the taller of the two men, it was the Lord Protector who drew the eye. He had put away his smiles for the day, it seemed. He listened solemnly as Royce introduced the knights who had accompanied him, then said, "My lords are welcome here. You know our Maester Coleman, of course. Lord Nestor, you will recall Elaine, my natural daughter?" "To be sure." Lord Nestor Royce was a bull-necked, battle-chested, balding man with a grey-shot beard and a stern look. He inclined his head a whole half-inch in greeting. Sansa curtsied, too frightened to speak for fear she might misspeak. Peter drew her to her feet. "Sweetling, be a good girl and bring Lord Robert to the High Hall to receive his guests." "Yes, father." Her voice sounded thin and strained. A liar's voice, she thought, as she hurried up the steps and across the gallery to the Moon Tower. A guilty voice. Gretchel and Maddie were helping Robert Arryn squirm into his breeches when Sansa stepped into his bedchamber. The Lord of the Eyrie had been crying again. His eyes were red and raw, his lashes crusty, his nose swollen and runny. A trail of snot glistened underneath one nostril, and his lower lip was bloody where he'd bitten it. Lord Nestor must not see him like this, Sansa thought, despairing. "Gretchel, fetch me the washbasin." She took the boy by the hand and drew him to the bed. "Did my sweet Robin sleep well last night?" "No," he sniffed. "I never slept one bit, Elaine. He was singing again, and my door was locked. I called for them to let me out, but no one ever came. Someone locked me in my room." That was wicked of them. Dipping a soft cloth into the warm water, she began to clean his face. Gently, oh so gently. If you scrubbed Robert too briskly, he might begin to shake. The boy was frail and terribly small for his age. He was 8, but Sansa had known bigger 5-year-olds. Robert's lip quivered. "I was going to come sleep with you." "I know you were." Sweet Robin had been accustomed to crawling in beside his mother until she wed Lord Peter. Since Lady Lysa's death, he had taken to wandering the Eyrie in quest of other beds. The one he liked best was Sansa's, which was why she had asked Sir Lothar Brune to lock his door last night. She would not have minded if he only slept, but he was always trying to nuzzle at her breasts, and when he had his shaking spells, he often wet the bed. "Lord Nestor Royce has come up from the gates to see you," Sansa wiped beneath his nose. "I don't want to see him," he said. "I want a story of the Winged Knight." "After," Sansa said. "First, you must see Lord Nestor." "Lord Nestor has a mole," he said, squirming. Robert was afraid of men with moles. "Mommy said he was dreadful." "My poor sweet Robin," Sansa smoothed his hair back. "You miss her, I know.
Lord Peter misses her too. He loved her just as you do. That was a lie, though kindly meant. The only woman Peter ever loved was Sansa's murdered mother. He had confessed as much to Lady Lysa just before he pushed her out the moon door. She was mad and dangerous. She murdered her own lord husband and would have murdered me if Peter had not come along to save me. Robert did not need to know that, though. He was only a sick little boy who loved his mother. "There," Sansa said, "you look a proper lord now. Maddie, fetch his cloak." It was lamb's wool, soft and warm, a handsome sky blue that set off the cream colour of his tunic. She fastened it about his shoulders with a silver brooch in the shape of a crescent moon and took him by the hand. Robert came meekly for once. The high hall had been closed since Lady Lysa's fall, and it gave Sansa a chill to enter it again. The hall was long and grand and beautiful, she supposed, but she did not like it here. It was a pale, cold place at the best of times. The slender pillars looked like finger bones, and the blue veins in the white marble brought to mind the veins in an old crone's legs. Though 50 silver sconces lined the walls, less than a dozen torches had been lit, so shadows danced upon the floors and pooled in every corner. Their footsteps echoed off the marble, and Sansa could hear the wind rattling at the moon door. "I must not look at it," she told herself, "else I'll start to shake as badly as Robert." With Maddie's help, she got Robert seated on his weirwood throne with a stack of pillows underneath him, and sent word that his lordship would receive his guests. Two guards in sky-blue cloaks opened the doors at the lower end of the hall, and Peter ushered them in and down the long blue carpet that ran between the rows of bone-white pillars. The boy greeted Lord Nestor with squeaky courtesy and made no mention of his mole. When the high steward asked about his lady mother, Robert's hands began to tremble ever so slightly.
"Marillion hurt my mother. He threw her out the moon door."
"Did your lordship see this happen?" asked Sir Marwyn Belmore, a lanky ginger-headed knight who had been Lysa's captain of guards till Peter had put Sir Lothar Broon in his place.
"Elaine saw it," the boy said, "and my lord's stepfather."
Lord Nestor looked at her. Sir Albar, Sir Marwyn, Maester Coleman, all of them were looking.
"She was my aunt, but she wanted to kill me," Sansa thought. "She dragged me to the moon door and tried to push me out. I never wanted a kiss. I was building a castle in the snow."
She hugged herself to keep from shaking. "Forgive her, my lords," Peter Baelish said softly. "She still has nightmares of that day. Small wonder if she cannot bear to speak of it." He came up behind her and put his hands gently on her shoulders. "I know how hard this is for you, Elaine, but our friends must hear the truth."
"Yes."
Her throat felt so dry and tight, it almost hurt to speak.
I was with the Lady Lysa when..."
A tear rolled down her cheek.
"That's good. A tear is good. When Marillion pushed her."
And she told the tale again, hardly hearing the words as they spilled out of her. Before she was half done, Robert began to cry, the pillows shifting perilously beneath him.
"He killed my mother. I want him to fly."
The trembling in his hands had grown worse, and his arms were shaking too. The boy's head jerked, and his teeth began to chatter.
"Fly!" he shrieked. "Fly! Fly!"
His arms and legs flailed wildly. Lothar Broon strode to the dais in time to catch the boy as he slipped from his throne. Maester Coleman was just a step behind, though there was naught that he could do. Helpless as the rest, Sansa could only stand and watch as the shaking spell ran its course. One of Robert's legs kicked Sir Lothar in the face. Broon cursed, but still held on as the boy twitched and flailed and wet himself. Their visitors said not a word. Lord Nestor, at least, had seen these fits before. It was long moments before Robert's spasms began to subside, and seemed even longer. By the end, the little lordling was so weak he could not stand.
"Best take his lordship back to bed and bleed him," Lord Peter said.
Broon lifted the boy in his arms and carried him from the hall. Maester Coleman followed, grim-faced.
When their footsteps died away, there was no sound in the high hall of the Eyrie. Sansa could hear the night wind moaning outside and scratching at the moon door. She was very cold and very tired. "Must I tell the tale again?" she wondered. But she must have told it well enough. Lord Nestor cleared his throat. "I misliked that singer from the first," he grumbled. "I urged Lady Lysa to send him away. Many a time I urged her." "You always gave her good counsel, my lord," Peter said. "She took no heed of it," Royce complained. "She heard me grudgingly and took no heed. My lady was too trusting for this world." Peter spoke so tenderly that Sansa would have believed he'd loved his wife. Lysa could not see the evil in men, only the good. Marillion sang sweet songs, and she mistook that for his nature. "He called us pigs," Sir Albar Royce said, a blunt, broad-shouldered knight who shaved his chin but cultivated thick black side whiskers that framed his homely face like hedgerows. Sir Albar was a younger version of his father. "He made a song about two pigs snuffling round a mountain, eating a falcon's leavings. That was meant to be us, but when I said so, he laughed at me. 'Why, sir, 'tis a song about some pigs,' he said." "He made mock of me as well," Sir Marwyn Belmore said. "Sir Ding Dong, he named me. When I vowed I'd cut his tongue out, he ran to Lady Lysa and hid behind her skirts." "As oft he did," Lord Nestor said. "The man was craven, but the favour Lady Lysa showed him made him insolent. She dressed him like a lord, gave him gold rings and a moonstone belt. Even Lord John's favourite falcon." The knight's doublet showed the six white candles of Waxley. "His lordship loved that bird. King Robert gave it to him." Peter Baelish sighed. "It was unseemly," he agreed, "and I put an end to it. Lysa agreed to send him away. That was why she met him here that day. I should have been with her, but I never dreamt if I had not insisted. It was I who killed her." "No," Sansa thought. "You mustn't say that. You mustn't tell them. You mustn't." But Albar Royce was shaking his head. "No, my lord. You must not blame yourself," he said. "This was the singer's work," his father agreed. "Bring him up, Lord Peter. Let us write an end to this sorry business." Peter Baelish composed himself and said, "As you wish, my lord." He turned to his guardsmen and spoke a command, and the singer was fetched up from the dungeons. The jailer Maud came with him, a monstrous man with small black eyes and a lopsided, scarred face. One ear and part of his cheek had been cleaved off in some battle, but 20 stone of pallid white flesh remained. His clothes fit poorly and had a rank, ripe smell. Marillion, by contrast, looked almost elegant. Someone had bathed him and dressed him in a pair of sky-blue breeches and a loose-fitting white tunic with puffed sleeves, belted with a silvery sash that had been a gift from Lady Lysa. White silk gloves covered his hands, while a white silk bandage spared the lords the sight of his eyes. Maud stood behind him with a lash. When the jailer prodded him in the ribs, the singer went to one knee. "Good lords, I beg your forgiveness." Lord Nestor scowled. "You confess your crime? If I had eyes, I should weep." The singer's voice, so strong and sure by night, was cracked and whispery now. "I loved her so. I could not bear to see her in another's arms, to know she shared his bed. I meant no harm to my sweet lady, I swear it. I barred the door, so no one could disturb us whilst I declared my passions, but Lady Lysa was so cold. When she told me that she was carrying Lord Peter's child, a madness seized me." Sansa stared at his hands while he spoke. Fat Maddy claimed that Maud had taken off 3 of his fingers, both pinkies and a ring finger. His little fingers did appear somewhat stiffer than the others, but with those gloves it was hard to be certain. It might have been no more than a story. How would Maddy know? "Lord Peter has been kind enough to let me keep my harp," the blind singer said. "My harp and my tongue, so I may sing my songs. Lady Lysa dearly loved my singing."
Take this creature away, or I'm like to kill him myself, Lord Nestor growled. It sickens me to look at him. Mord, take him back to his sky cell, said Peter.
Yes, ma'am.